The following is the 14th part of a 15-part special teaching by Dr. Kenneth Boa on paradigm spirituality.
Continuing on our journey through the concept of the temporal versus the eternal, what I call paradigm spirituality, we were saying that our presuppositions, our worldview, will shape our perspective on life. And that perspective, in turn, will shape our priorities, and that our priorities will affect our practice. So we go from top down as we consider the issue of what our lives are meant to be, why we're here. I want us kind of to tie these threads together in the last couple of sessions on this. The Western world in which we live, of course, is an incredibly blessed and unique place. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, there's never a civilization like the one we enjoy. I don't know if you realize how privileged you really are in a wide variety of ways to have the options and opportunities that few people would have even been able to dream of. And yet, we're like, in some ways, like a kid that just discovered he was lost at a county fair. He's surrounded by all the things that he loves, all the games, the cotton candy, and everything else that he loves to have, and yet suddenly he can't enjoy a bit of it because he realizes he has no idea where his parents are. And in a lot of ways, we are lost as well. We don't have an idea of who we are and what our purpose is. At least a lot of people I run into haven't got really a larger picture. They enjoy the little things, but then they fail to realize what life is all about. What I have here is a little chart that illustrates the theme of moving from conduct to choices. Well, let's go bottom up on this one. We start with our calling, and another way of looking at this is that we have our calling before God, that He has called us, and our point here is that that's the identification that we have. So this is kind of like a top down, but it's up, it's upside down. We start, this is still the top, even though it's in the bottom of the chart. That is to say, who you are is what God defines you to be in this world. And so that calling should then, in effect, shape our convictions. And that when we, the more we come to grasp who we are and what life's supposed to be about, that ought to give us a set of convictions which we embrace. Those convictions, in turn, must be coupled with courage, which is faith in God and what He's called us to pursue. Remember, it takes a tremendous amount of courage, a tremendous amount of risk, to be convinced that actually the invisible will outlast the visible. That the unseen and the temporal, the unseen is going to be that which endures. The seen is passing away. And so we realize then that it takes courage to make the choices that are compatible with a worldview that tells us that we must treasure the not yet over the now, treasure the unseen over the seen. That those choices that we make ultimately will affect our conduct, and all of this is what we mean by character. As we grow in the development of character, we're called to develop in a number of ways that cause us to become different. That there's got to be some evidential difference in our lives. Someone once put it this way, if you were arrested for being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? Which is an interesting way of looking at it. I'm just consider the ambient environment in which we live. Think of commercials. Commercials seem to tout four primary things. They seem to tout beauty, one-upmanship, materialism, and personal peace. If we look, you know, you have 13 commercials every 30 minutes. I don't know if people are aware of this. It's quite interesting. They'll do a bunch of commercials, and then they'll bring, and our show will continue. No, they get just give you enough of a tantalizer, and then they can give you another barrage of another four or five commercials there, back to back. I notice this particularly because I never watch them. I always record. If I'm going to watch something, I record it. Now, you'd like your TiVo, and I'm probably going to get one, but still. What I do is, if I'm going to see something, say it's a movie or whatever it is, that I want to record, then I watch it at leisure as I go, actually when I'm in the kitchen. I've learned to see things in a serialized manner. That's just the way I now do it. So 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, when I'm having a little snack or whatever. But what's fun to do is to fast forward the commercials. And what's interesting is to count them as you fast forward them. And you count how many there are, and then they have the little breaker, which gave you the illusion you're back. And then a few more after that. It's just quite remarkable how people just They just dully stare at these things. But I find them, there are four things. Beauty is the first thing. I mean, you don't see a lot of ugly people on TV when you stop and think about it. Look at whether it's soap operas or whether it is sitcoms, very few ugly people. Years ago, Bartles and James were about the closest you'd get. And then one-upmanship is another huge thing. The implication is if you buy this product, you will have the edge on other people. You will look better, or you will have more success, or whatever it might happen to be, which relates to the idea of materialism, the idea of a card. Remember, it used to be, which card was it? So worldly, so welcome. That was an interesting giveaway. So worldly, so welcome. Wasn't that? I can't remember. Was it MasterCard? I think it was MasterCard. They're naming that thing for what it is. I mean, you use plastic to buy something you don't need, with money you don't have, to impress people you don't even know. I mean, it's quite remarkable how people have gotten sucked into this. Materialism, and then personal peace. You deserve a break today. Maybe you don't. Commercials, what they do is they kind of promote a kind of mystique. They sell an image that's not really a substance. It's an illusion. Think about the Marlboro Man. What attributes would you associate with the Marlboro Man whenever you see him on posters, on television commercials? He's independent. What else do you think about him? I mean, he's strong, isn't he? He's good looking. He's rugged. He's in control of his life, so it would seem. He seems to be a person who is almost like the idea of the quintessential Western character, hero. He's independent. He's not tied down. If we were being realistic, actually, we would see the Marlboro Man in an emphysema ward with tubes up his nose, gasping for the little air his diseased lungs will hold. That's what we would see. The fact is that there's a guy who can smoke cigarettes with impunity and have no consequences whatsoever. I like the story about a minister who years ago, when there were sometimes you'd have these long gas lines, he waited to have his car filled just before a long vacation. And this is the days when they had attendants. Remember those days where they actually had people who would do that? Of course, now you pay more for it if it's not self-service. And he was really in a long, long line on that holiday weekend. So he waited a long time, and finally the attendant motioned him up to an empty pump. And the young man, this guy was a minister, and so he said, Reverend, I'm sorry about the delay. It seems as if everyone waits until the last minute to get ready for a long trip. The minister said, I can understand that. It's the same in my business. And it's true. Everybody waits till the last minute to get ready for a long trip. I find that it's intriguing here because in our vision, if ours is an eternal perspective, we will be gripped by a biblical truth. And this biblical truth is that we really are here for a brief moment, a brief sojourn. And it's not pessimistic, it's realistic. It's to say, the more we understand the brevity of our sojourn, the more we'll treasure the time we have and the opportunities we've been given. That it's designed, this sojourn, to prepare us for our eternal citizenship in heaven. I'm thinking particularly in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 10. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. He went out not knowing where he was going. That's what I mean by courage. There are times when you're called to go somewhere and you don't know where he's calling you to go. And he goes on to say, by faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise, for he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. That's the city he was looking at, not built with human hands, but rather the architect was one who put it together, who is the one for whom we were called. So ultimately, Abraham saw himself as we should see ourselves, pilgrims in this world. Strangers, exiles, aliens in exile, sojourners in this brief planet. And so understanding that this sojourn is designed to prepare us for our eternal citizenship in heaven will have some impact, it should at least, on our long-term and short-term priorities. I read a story about how a mother decided to make a special meal for her family. It was turkey with mashed potatoes and gravy and corn and green beans and cranberry sauce and apple pie for dessert. And these foods really, this was everyone's favorite meal, especially when it wasn't Thanksgiving. And the kids couldn't wait hearing, smelling the aroma to eat that night. And the youngest son came in just before it was time to sit down at the table, and he was just poking at his food and didn't eat anything. And even though those were his favorite foods, he wasn't able to eat them. Turns out he had just filled up on peanut butter at the house next door. So his appetite, what he did is filled himself up with a secondary good, and he lost his appetite for the primary good. Does that sound familiar with you? The idea is it's very easy for you to lose a taste or an appetite for the highest good by satisfying yourself with secondary goods. And that's really the struggle, I think, that we always face in our own lives and in our own journeys. Part of the issue is, a friend of mine, Gordon Adams, liked to put it this way. He says you might want to compare life to a brief stay at a hotel. It's an interesting way of looking at this. In some cases, the hotel is a flea bag. And in others, there may be mints in the pillows and flowers on the table. You know, so sometimes you get the Motel 6, and sometimes you get the Ritz. But the fact is this. Whatever the hotel's rating, you're living out of suitcases. Now think of it that way. When you go to a hotel, perhaps you don't like the decor. What do you say? These curtains have to go. We need to get new carpet in here. Do you ever worry about that stuff? Now, the reality is, you know that you're only there for a short time. You're living out of a suitcase. And so you don't think about changing the decor. You may not like it, but the point is simply this, that we know it's not our home, so we don't concern changing those things. In a very similar way, it's a mistake to confuse hotel life with the glorious place he's got in store for us. That God never meant us to confuse room service with home-cooked meals. You know, you can only get so far on that. And my point is simply this, that we all are having room service. We're all really in a hotel. We're all waiting, really, for home. We're not home yet. And that's a journey, that's a destination, that is a place that God is preparing for us. Because part of my desire is for us to admit, really, that there is far, far more in our desires than this world can satisfy. Stop and come into contact with your deepest desires, and you know it's true. What are the things you'd most deeply long for? You'll discover that your deepest desires, your deepest longings, cannot be satisfied through people, possessions, or position. If you really are honest with it, even if you attained the things you think you want, you'd discover it left you empty, that you still didn't have enough. That there'd always be this quest for more. My view is that, as Pascal put it, there's this infinite abyss, it seems, between God and ourselves. People often say he said that there is a God-shaped vacuum between man and God. I can't find that in his writings. But I think what they mean is that there's this infinite abyss which only God can fit. Same idea, basically. But the idea here is that only he can answer to our needs because, as Augustine put it, you've made us for yourselves, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. That's just the reality of it. So you will experience in this journey, this sojourn, this hotel, the restless heart. I think it was in this problem of pain that Lewis put it this way, when he said that our Heavenly Father has given us many pleasant inns along the road of life, but he never meant to us to mistake them for home. That's the idea. That you're not home yet is really a theme in Scripture of these characters, for example, in Hebrews chapter 11. It goes on to say in Hebrews 11, after talking about Abraham and Sarah, all these died in faith, verse 13, without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. You will not receive the promises in this world. You just understand that. He'll give you a lot of good things in many ways, and there'll be a lot of pain and sorrow too, because it's a fallen world. And we're never guaranteed the idea that we will somehow be excused from any of those sorrows and pains and heartbreaks. We will be filled with disappointments. In fact, it's my conviction that those disappointments can, in fact, be used by God to transfer our hope from this world to the next. To transfer our desires for what we think we want to what we really want, what we really need. As some of you know, I describe heaven. I picked this up from Eldridge's book. I think it was The Journey of Desire, where he described the three things of intimacy, beauty, and adventure as being characteristics of what heaven's really all about, of what God's really got in store for us. And so the way you try to leverage an image of heaven, because we don't have any memories of heaven, that's the problem there. You know, God's going to tell us it's going to be more than worth your while. But you have to take his word for it, because you haven't been there yet. None of us have any memories of it. But I think Eldridge is right when he tells us, let's leverage these three things. So you must ask yourself, what is the greatest moment of intimacy you've ever known with another person? That's a question you want to ask yourself right away. Or what are the great moments of intimacy? Not only sexual intimacy, but also intimacy in friendships, where there's an unimpeded openness that you can have with another person. What's the greatest moments of intimacy you've ever had with another person? I bet a lot of you are thinking of specific things right now. The idea here is that you must use that as an illustration, as only a kind of hint of what real intimacy will be about. You haven't had the real thing yet. Those are only little tidbits of what's awaiting for us. My view here is that the greatest moment of intimacy we've ever enjoyed with another human being is only a hint of the communion of saints that will be available for us with all believers in the days ahead. Days, the eternity ahead. Remembering that this earth is so fleeting and ephemeral, but the next life, the eternal dwellings, are going to go on forever, and it's further up and higher, and it keeps getting better than it was before. So my conviction, first of all, is intimacy can be a hint of home. If you think about that for a moment, you can leverage your experience, go from the known to the unknown. Does that make sense, that concept? You always go from the known to the unknown. We have experiences of intimacy here. Let that be a hint of what God has promised to be far, far greater. No comparison. What about the greatest moment of beauty that you've ever experienced? So think of that for a moment. What might it have been? It could have been something in nature. It could have been something in music or art. Something you experienced that was extraordinarily beautiful. It was a moment that you didn't want to go away. You wished it could last forever, that sort of a thing. It was something that perhaps you wanted to share with another person. Because often when we see something exquisite, our first impulse is to share it with another person, which is part of the whole idea then of not just enjoying it alone. And you have to, again, use that idea. What's the greatest moment of beauty you've ever experienced? Again, the beauty of the next world, of what God's got in store for us, far surpasses our concept to imagine it. We can only use these hints of home. The intimacy and the beauty will be quite extraordinary. The third thing is adventure. And again, ask yourself this question. What's the greatest moment of adventure you've ever experienced? What's the greatest experience you've had that has been truly joyful or fun or adventuresome? And again, it goes on to follow that moment of adventure is a hint of heaven. Most people's idea of heaven is crashingly boring. It's just incredibly dull and static. We've talked about this before, but I'm always interested in that phrase, rest in peace, because, you know, R.I.P. You know, what are you doing? I'm resting. What are you doing? I'm resting. Rest, 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 rest. I'm in peace. Rest, rest, rest. But there's got to be something more than that. I know I've shared this before, but I like the cartoon so much. It's did I give you this one, the Gary Larson cartoon with the guy on the cloud, and he's floating around there, and he's got his halo. He's got his white robes. He's got his harp. You know, he's got his cloud, all the accoutrements. And as he's floating around, he calls off to somebody else on their own cloud, "Hey, are there any magazines up here?" You know, how long are you going to be wanting to strum your harp, you know? Maybe 5-10 minutes is fine, but after 5 days it gets kind of dull. Would you not agree with that? What's the problem here? The problem is not with God's vision of heaven, but with ours. The problem is that we have a deficient imagination. We've reduced it to something that, in my opinion, would be incredibly boring. It would be like an eternal life sentence to boredom. A lot of philosophers actually have used this as an argument to claim that there is no immortality of the soul. Their argument is this, that if in fact the soul were immortal, that we would eventually become so incredibly bored that we would go nuts. What's the deficiency in that argument? What do you think?
We've seen all there is to see.
On this earth?
We don't know what's yet to come.
But suppose their argument would be, whatever it is yet to come, it's going to eventually become tedious. Because after a while, you'll continue to do the yet to come, and finally it'll be old hat, would be their argument.
You don't understand the infinity of God.
The infinity of God? Unpacked it a little bit.
Well, they think whatever's there is exhaustible.
Exhaustible, yeah. That's, I think, very, very real issue, that they failed to grasp the inexhaustibility of the living God, that the more you learn about Him, the more you'll realize you do not know about Him. Isn't that true in the created order? I mean, when I do my Powers of Ten presentation, the more I study the science of molecular biology and the specified complexity and the fine-tuning of the universe, the more I'm impressed. I mean, just take the DNA. How on earth does 6 feet of DNA get squeezed into this little cell? And you have 100 trillion of these cells. How on earth? Nobody really knows fully. They know it has very cunning systems of spooling within spools. And they don't know how it opens up enough, but it has to unspool enough to allow this transfer RNA to copy the thing and then send it on to other parts of the cell as it copies and creates a protein, the template for a protein. The issue is this. How does the thing unspool? And it's doing this thousands of times a minute. And it's constantly creating new proteins, thousands a minute, in your body. It's more efficient than any factory we've ever even dreamed of, one cell. More efficient, actually, in many ways, if you look at all the networks of the cell, than the entire city of Atlanta, in terms of its electrical circuitry, transportation system, the manufacturing systems, it's exquisitely complex. The interesting thing is, the more we learn about the cell, you would have thought, wouldn't you, that once you've learned about it, you got it down? That was the old idea. You know, it was just a bunch of protoplasm, and the more we have it down. Darwin's day, that was the idea, that the cell is just a bunch of protoplasm, and we'll sort that out. And that's how you could eventually get one out of the primordial soup. Turns out it's not a bunch of protoplasm. It turns out that it's so elegant, so complex, so beyond our comprehension, that we didn't even have the categories for it. And that's why Michael Behe calls his book Darwin's Black Box. The cell was just a black box, didn't know what was in it. And now we know, have a better idea. And the more you learn about it, the more you realize this thing is irreducibly complex. This thing is filled with information. The DNA in your body, that 6 feet strand, with about 3.2 billion nucleotide pairs, is actually filled with more information than the entire set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's filled with information. Whence comes this? And how do these things then express themselves in behavior and instinct? We don't have a clue. My point is this. I promise you, 10 years from now, if we're still on the planet before we destroy ourselves, I have to tell you, I'm scared about nanotechnology and robotics and the development of androids. As you know, they're trying to eliminate the distinction between man and machine by turning men into machines and machines into men. It's very, very interesting. If you want to really find a chilling series, there's a two-part series called Beyond Human put up. It was a PBS series, came out a couple of years ago. You won't believe where things are heading. And the interesting thing is, it's all justified by utilitarianism. If it works, it must be good. Without any grasp of unintended consequences, the arrogance and naivete that is associated with that boggles my imagination. My point here is this, trying to play God is what we're trying to do. It was bad enough when we are trying to, now that we try to destroy life created in the image of God, now we're trying to create life in the image of man. In many ways, that's just as chilling, if not more. And the frightening idea here is that we think we can play God. We don't have a clue as to what we're doing. So my view is this, if we're around 10 years from now, it'll be even more elegant, more amazing, more bizarre in many ways, this world, than we ever dreamed it to be. My conviction is that We haven't even scratched the surface, and this is a fallen world. What do you suppose the next world will be like as it reflects its beauty and glory? Whenever I look at any collection of what God's made in the created order, I'm impressed with it. Why does He need that diversity, that variety? I bought Karen a book for her birthday, which is this botanical book that just has these beautiful color illustrations of thousands of different kinds of flowers, as well as shrubs and trees and so forth. And I look through those things. When I go through a garden, it's the same thing. I was up in upstate New York speaking, and there were some gardens there, flowers that I hadn't seen in that particular garden. And when I look at these things, I say, my word, who would have invented this thing? We were walking through, I was climbing up a mountain with my friend, don't make it a big deal, it was only 700 feet high. as we're going up this, prominence, we're stunned, we're stunned, this hill, all right, as we're going up the hill, you notice how we inflate things, our memories have a way of inflating as time goes by, the thing was 10,000 feet if it was a foot, but you know, one of the things we'd stop from time to time and notice things, because it was just under this extraordinary canopy of trees, mostly deciduous. They have a lot more deciduous trees up there. We have mostly pines down here. Loblolly is wonderful. But the fact is that it was quite extraordinary. You'd see this. Look at this. Look at that. I was looking at a mushroom, for example. And I said to my friend, you know, if you had never seen a mushroom, even if you'd seen flowers, you would have never invented this thing. When you turn it upside down, you see the pattern underneath, the texture and so forth. Who would have thunk it up? You see the point here? Who could have possibly imagined it? Remember, maybe you won't remember, but there was a letter that an 8-year-old wrote to Dr. Seuss some years ago. She said, Dr. Seuss, you sure thunk up a lot of funny characters. Dr. Seuss, you sure thunk up a lot of funny stories. Who thunk you up, Dr. Seuss? Which is a wonderful question. Who thunk us up and the world? Who would have imagined this stuff? If you didn't have those things to begin with, who would have dreamt of it? And it's true with take anything you want, whether it's insects or minerals, you name it, anything you look at, it's beyond your imagination, the diversity and complexity that there is. My wife loves to grow orchids, and we probably have about 50 varieties. May I tell you that there are over 30,000 species of orchids alone. Over 30,000 species. A species, it means it is distinguishably different from another kind. Why do you need 30,000 species of orchids? Many of you know that I'm fond of quoting the statistic that there are actually 300,000 species of beetles. Who needs 300,000 different kinds of beetles? He loves the things, evidently. And each one of them, I was, again, up in upstate New York, there were some roses there, and I pulled off, it was kind of, we call it honeymoon haven there. It was every one of the... on this particular rose bush, it was the Japanese beetle. They're all mating, every one of them. You know, nobody was alone. They all found their partners. And it was funny. Maybe something perverse me. I pulled them off, and they kind of fell apart, and they just sat there. Must have been exhausted. one of them whispered to the other, was it good for you? But the fact is that they kind of just lay in there. But, you know, I looked at the thing. And I just studied it for, you know, it's the first time I really looked closely at a Japanese beetle. And while we regard them as a nuisance, I started studying the thing. The beautiful emerald head and the exquisite copper wings that it has, the backs on it, and it has these little parallel lines on it. It's elegant. It's marvelous. The little joints on this thing, the eyes, everything about it. If I had a magnifying glass, I would have been even more impressed to see the variety. So God creates that, and that's only one of 300,000. It's almost like He says, here, I'm going to show you one. Now you create 10 of them, but they all have to be different. See, how well would we do? Now after doing 10, okay, now I want you to make 1,000 of them. Now after 1,000, make 30,000. Now 300. You see what I'm trying to say here? He, I think, loves to be profligate in his creative order. He loves to display his incredible, unbounded creativity. And that's why my belief is that the more we study the created order and the beauty that God's given us, the more we study about the beauty of life itself and the gift of life and the preciousness there is of intimate relationships and extraordinary experiences that we can enjoy, the more I think we can appreciate and have a capacity for home. My desire, again, is to cause you to increase your desires, your longings, so much that you finally admit that nothing on the earth can satisfy them. That's really what I want to do. If you'll finally come to the point where you finally admit that nothing on this earth will satisfy your deep abiding longings because you were not meant for this earth. This earth is to prepare you from home. I'm teaching a course on mere Christianity at Christ Church on Sunday mornings. And it's really an enjoyable thing because I'm slowly working my way through it. Once before I did it in 1 hour, and then I did a 4-hour version. Now this will take about, I don't know, maybe 30 sessions. What do you think, Alva? Probably about 30 times. So I'm easing my way through this material. And I found a wonderful quote from one of the forwards to Mere Christianity, this one written by Kathleen Norris. Here's how she puts it. The Christianity Lewis espouses is humane, but not easy. It asks us to recognize that the great religious struggle is not fought on a spectacular battleground, but within the ordinary human heart. Did you all catch that? That's where the struggle is. It's within the heart. When every morning we awake and feel the pressures of the day crowding in on us, and we must decide what sort of immortals we wish to be. Every day you awake, feel the pressures of the day. They're crowding in on you, and you need to decide what sort of immortal that you wish to be, because you are an immortal creature. You do know this. Whether you like it or not, when this earth is gone, you will still be. You were meant for the eternities, and therefore it would be well for us to discuss and decide and see how what we do now does shape and affect eternity. So as I look at this concept then, I want to make a contrast then between the world systems and show really that at the end of the day, it's not nearly as satisfying. You see, the world will tout money, ambition, sex, and clout. Money, ambition, sex, and clout. But the word proposes something very different. Instead of money, it proposes wealth, Ephesians 1-3. If we just look at the book of Ephesians, wealth. The first three chapters of Ephesians tells us about your spiritual wealth, which transcends any of the money, any of the acquisitions that we could ever attain. Give me one example of that wealth from Ephesians 1-3. Anyone come to mind? Just checking you out here. You haven't been reading Ephesians 1-3 lately, I can tell. You've been blessed with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. In Him we have an inheritance. In Him we have found redemption. In fact, God's intention is to show us kindness in the days ahead and the eternity to come, that we are seated with Him right now at the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. I'd call that pretty impressive, wouldn't you? The wealth that we have in those first three chapters is extraordinary, far more impressive than any earthly wealth. And then the second contrast is between ambition and purpose. The world touts ambition. The scriptures tout promote purpose. They teach us to pursue purpose. Ephesians chapter 4:1 through 5:17, if you'd study that, you'll discover that's your purpose. You discover that God has actually revealed not only who you are, but what He invites you to do and become. Now there is, as I like to put it, there is an ultimate purpose for which He's created all things. And we really don't have a full grasp of why did He create us at all? He sure didn't need us. He wasn't lonely. In the perfect triunity and the love between the Father, Son, and the Spirit, there was perfect love, communion, other-centeredness and so forth, relationship. Why did He need us? He wasn't lonely. But He decides, for reasons known only to Himself, out of the overflow of His beauty and love and grace, to create beings who could be moral agents who would respond to His loving and overtures and initiatives. And as I see this then, I think that the ultimate purpose that God has to do with His own glory and with His own pleasure in displaying that glory and enhancing His pleasure. And we would say, well, isn't that a little self-centered? Not if you're God. Not if you're the source of all things. It would be wrong for us to pursue glory and as an end in itself. But in fact, when we don't honor Him, there's something wrong. You see the idea there? Because if He's the one who made it, then He should be honored. And so as I see it then, we have this image here of what God has created for us. So instead of money, Scripture promotes wealth. Instead of ambition, it promotes purpose. The secondary level of purpose is the universal purpose. And I believe that all followers of Christ are called to this universal purpose, to come to know Christ and make Him known. That is to say, edification and evangelism. In one way or another, we're all called to grow and reproduce. How that looks, though, in your life is your unique purpose. So we go from ultimate to universal to unique. What is your unique purpose? In other words, in what unique way has He given you the calling of growing and reproducing and having an impact on the people that He's given you as a stewardship? All of us have people in our lives that He's entrusted to us in a stewardship, and He's given us truth, and He's given us enough time to accomplish His purposes. He's given us the kind of talent we need to achieve that, and He's given us the resources we need as well. These are all matters of stewardship, but they all relate to our purpose. Third, instead of sex, the Scriptures promote something deeper than that. Not that sex is overlooked, but actually the love that the Scriptures promote provides a greater context for intimacy and the relationship between a husband and a wife, but also for love that we have in all of our relationships, love for our parents and our children and our friends, our neighbors. In other words, love, Ephesians chapter 5, 18 through 6, 9, is the third section, so that you have wealth in Ephesians 1 to 3, you have a true sense of purpose in Ephesians 4, 1 to 5, 17, where He's given us spiritual gifts and so forth and told us how to use it. He's given us a calling for love in our relationships with one another, 5:18 to 6:9. And finally, instead of clout that the world touts, the Word promotes power, the sort of power that the world has never seen. People fight, as you know, for power. They've killed for power. But the sort of power we're talking about here is a power that actually transcends anything that this world has ever known. It is a power that terrified Pilate, Pontius Pilate. Remember, he was the governor. And you recall, he began to become increasingly afraid of this prisoner he had before him. He says, "Who are you?" He was beginning to wonder what sort of man this might be. When he said, "What is truth?" in a sort of cynical way, he had no idea of who he was talking to. The incarnation of truth was right before him, and he failed to see Him. There's a power. My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, I could have called my servants, and they would have, in fact, delivered me. Remember, he says elsewhere that I could have called 12 legions of angels. One would have been enough to destroy all of the whole area. He didn't need that. He says, if my kingdom were of this world, it would be one thing. Then my servants would fight. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this world. And Pontius Pilate couldn't grasp what he's talking about. Your kingdom is not of this world. Your kingdom is to use these things in this world to, in fact, be about the king's business. As you know, you are an ambassador and you are a steward. As an ambassador, you represent the affairs of another. As an ambassador, then, you're on the king's business. You have a mission. You have a particular calling. And the king will ask us how we did with that. As a steward, you manage the affairs of another. So as an ambassador, you are really representing the concerns of another, his mission, his purposes. And as a steward, you actually are using the materials that God has given you. He has given you a certain stewardship, and you're responsible for that which is owned by another. So that's a calling, I think, that we all have. Now, I believe that, therefore, we're not called to chase shadows when we are offered real substance. So I want to conclude by asking this question: what will endure in the end? What can we take with us Or do we leave everything behind? And you know the biblical answer is this. When you you leave everything behind, the old idea that there's no U-Haul behind a hearse. You leave everything behind, but yet there is something you can send ahead. And you know what that is. The people into whose lives you've entrusted yourself, that you've entrusted God's truth and word, that you've built into their lives, the other-centered love you've invested in people will go on ahead because they're eternal beings, and you've taken eternal truth and you've invested it in eternal beings. When you go to a country, another country, what do you have to do when you first get there? After you go through passport control, what's the first thing you normally do? You change your money, right? You have to change your currency. May I say that the currency of this earth is not the same as the currency of God's kingdom. The currency of this earth may be money, but the currency of heaven is people. And the relationships you be, so that you would do well then, as we move into the next world, to have previously invested the resources of this world into people who will go on into the next. That as I see it then, the relationships that we express in terms of serving people with eternal values at heart, that's what's going to endure forever.
To order additional copies of this CD or other selections from Ken Boa's teachings, call 800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 800-372-9632. Or contact us through the Reflections Ministries website at www.reflectionsministries.org.